I'm Joe Heap, author of The Rules of Seeing, and you're listening to Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. I'm your host Red Sail, and this week we delve into a brand new novel with sight loss at its core, The Rules of Seeing. Author Joe Heap reveals his deeply personal reasons for writing the book.
While obviously he couldn't understand a word I was saying, I wanted to be able to reach out and explain to him the presumably very bewildering things that he was seeing in front of him.
Actress Cariad Lloyd reveals the impact that narrating the book had on her.
Because if you're doing an advert voiceover, obviously you don't really get to, you know, you get 10 seconds of, and a nice voiceover. So I was very excited about doing a proper audiobook and being able to do different characters and tell a story.
The RNIB Connect Radio Book Group discussed their reaction to the story.
If you have got some sight, even if it's a small amount of sight, but enough to recognise something, it is very odd if you've never been able to see it before. You look at something and you think, what on earth is that? And then when you pick it up, it's obvious.
And throughout the show, we'll be previewing the audiobook ahead of its publication next week. That's all coming up on today's Read On.
HarperCollins presents The Rules of Seeing by Joe Heap. Read by Cariad Lloyd. Unattended luggage may be destroyed. Nova stands on the platform, waiting for the train doors to open. The February wind bleeds heat through the denim of her jeans. She dislikes Paddington. She dislikes all the big London termini. The tube she can manage and the smaller stations. But King's Cross and St Pancras, Euston and Paddington, they're all too big, too loud and echoing with too many people in a rush to be somewhere else. With Paddington, at least, she remembers the way to the ticket office from previous journeys, where she can ask for help in getting to the platform. Now she just hopes there won't be an alteration. Sometimes, Nova wishes she still had a guide dog. It would help with big journeys like this, with so many connections. But day to day, she can find her way with her white stick and doesn't have to clean up after a golden retriever.
Nova can do many things, but there's one thing Nova can't do, she can't see. When an operation restores her sight, Nova wakes up to a world she no longer understands, until she meets Kate. As their unlikely friendship blossoms, Kate's past threatens to throw them into a different kind of darkness. Can they both learn to see the world in a different way? That's the question posed on the dust jacket of Joe Heap's debut novel, The Rules of Seeing. It's published next week, and it's a thought-provoking psychological thriller that has sight loss and how it's perceived at its core. I met Joe earlier this year and soon discovered that he was determined that his book should be an accurate reflection of blindness and what it means to see for the first time. Joe Heap, author of The Rules of Seeing, welcome to Read On.
Hi, Red. Lovely to be here.
You're here to witness the recording of The Rules of Seeing.
I am.
How's that been going?
It's been going fantastic. It's my first book and it's the first audiobook of mine that I've seen recorded. It's very special. It's a strange feeling hearing your words read back to you, but it's especially strange hearing the characters being voiced. I think I welled up a little bit because it's almost like they're real all of a sudden, which is, yeah, it's very special.
And you've got the wonderful Cariad Lloyd narrating.
That's right. It's funny, I was listening to Cariad on the No Such Thing as a Fish podcast, I think a couple of days before my producer got in touch and said they were thinking of contacting Cariad. And I kind of felt like I was being trolled or something, like someone had bugged my phone and was listening in on me, because it's just, I find her hilarious. She's a brilliant actress. She's got a lovely voice. And it just seemed like such a perfect match to me. So I was thrilled when Cariad accepted.
Tell us a little bit more about The Rules of Seeing.
So The Rules of Seeing is about two women, Kate and Nova. Nova is 30 years old. She's been blind from birth. She is an interpreter for the Metropolitan Police. She speaks five languages. And she is offered an operation that will restore or give her sight for the first time. At hospital, she meets Kate, who is a successful architect. She's recently had a fall at home and banged her head, and she's starting to suspect that her husband, Tony, isn't the man that she thought he was. And Kate and Nova become friends, and over the course of the book, they become more than friends.
The strapline is, seeing is a matter of what you're looking for, which clearly there's a mystery aspect at the centre of the book as well.
Yes, I suppose playing on the different meanings of the word seeing. Obviously, a big part of the book is Nova's learning to see for the first time. And the title of the book, The Rules of Seeing, comes from her trying to codify for herself the very confusing world that she's been thrust into, because suddenly her brain is receiving a lot of sensory information that she has no way of processing, no way of separating out and understanding. So that's a big part of it. And it's also seeing in the sense of how we perceive other people's lives and how well we empathise with them, how much we miss in our everyday dealings with people, how much goes on beneath the surface, shall we say.
Nova has some residual sight, like 95% of us.
That's right. She can see light and dark and red in good light, but she can't see any clear detail, and she can't really use her sight to navigate in any significant way.
Which, I must say, as a blind person who has exactly that kind of residual sight, I found rather refreshing, because you used the line, you know, blindness isn't binary, and it's one of the greatest problems I think a lot of us have, is trying to explain to people why we are squinting at our mobile phone on the tube in spite of the fact that we have a white stick.
Absolutely, yeah. I think I've known several blind people or people with vision loss, and that's the thing that's always struck me, is that none of them have been in complete darkness, as it were. They've all had some degree of sight, even if that was only being able to perceive the difference between light and dark. But often it was a degree of vision that was useful to them. With Nova, I wanted to write a character for whom that residual sight was not useful in any significant way, but it was a part of her world, that it was that was the world that she had grown up with and the way that she felt comfortable.
So, what did you want to talk about? Nova asks. Not that I mind. It's good to eat somewhere other than the Scotland Yard canteen. Tell me about it. Hospital food is as bad as its reputation. Nova smiles but says nothing. She's waiting. So, I wanted to tell you about something I read in a journal. An operation. She frowns, still smiling. What kind of operation, doctor? Are you trying to get me lobotomised? He ignores the joke. An operation that could cure you. I mean, restore your sight. He knows that restore is the wrong word. You can't restore something that was never there. This is the moment that their sandwiches arrive and Nova stays silent. When she speaks again, her voice is quiet. What are you talking about? 80%, maybe more? Chance of seeing something. Chance of seeing everything. Her brother's voice, so familiar to Nova, is made exotic by excitement. That's a bold claim. Yes, she can hear him smiling, but true. She sits back, kicking her Doc Martens under her chair. The quick echoes of their words tell her that they are in a corner booth. He is trying to judge her reaction. When she speaks, she feels like an actor. Her response is pre-prepared. Most people think of blindness as darkness. I know, but you can see black and white and red in good light. No, that's not what I mean.
For want of a better word, did you do your research through the people with sight loss that you know, or did you go online and look at things like the RNIB website?
I've researched it extensively, but the thing that started me off, the thing that made me want to write the book in the first place, was an account by a guy called Michael May, who wrote a piece for The Guardian, I think it was maybe 2003 or 4, and he was an amazing guy. He'd been blinded in a chemical accident when he was 3 years old. He'd gone on to be a very successful entrepreneur. He set up a company that marketed pioneering GPS technology for helping blind people navigate, and I think he still has the record for fastest downhill skiing, which just seems incredible to me, just amazing. So he's an amazing guy, but at the age of 46, his doctor offered him the opportunity to potentially have some of his sight restored using retinal transplants and stem cell therapy. And he thought about it and decided to go for the treatment. And the account that he wrote was fascinating, very moving, but also I think the thing that I took away from it was that learning to see was not a straightforward positive experience, that people, you know, you're used to these inspirational kind of 30-second videos where someone's fitted with a hearing aid for the first time and it's fantastic and they can listen to music, for instance. But his experience was very much mixed. There were some fantastic things that he could see, beautiful landscapes, but at the same time he found it very confusing trying to follow what someone was saying while also watching their mouth move, and that this new sensory information was really hindering him in many ways, as opposed to working in tandem with his other senses, which he was so used to.
Absolutely. Those of us with sight loss have got used to the way we perceive the world, and it's not just an on-off switch. I think that's a nuanced argument, which, you know, I'm delighted is going to be actually debated in public, because blindness isn't necessarily something that we see on the television or outdoors every day.
I think that's right, and I think that blindness is often portrayed very negatively. It's something not to be desired, and it's really a hindrance to characters in fiction. And I didn't want that to be the case in this book. I wanted a character who was perfectly happy, perfectly accomplished and capable, not despite their blindness, but because that was their world and that was what they were used to. And while I wanted to write about them gaining sight, I didn't want that to seem like a miracle experience or a wholly positive experience, but as a kind of an adventure into a new way of perceiving the world.
Now, you said that Michael's article was one inspiration. I know there was a more personal inspiration that came partway through writing the book as well.
That's right, yeah. So I was about 6 months into writing the book when my son was born, and Sam came along on a very cold February morning. I think up to that point, I hadn't really thought about the idea of creating rules for seeing, the idea of codifying this new experience in some way. The thing that I immediately noticed with Sam was that he was noticing things, that he was looking at clouds, that he was looking at water, ripples on water. And these were really direct inspirations for some of the rules in the book, because while obviously he couldn't understand a word I was saying, I wanted to be able to reach out and explain to him the presumably very bewildering things that he was seeing in front of him. I think I was struck by certain things, like how he probably couldn't understand intangible concepts. So I watched him track an aeroplane across the sky one day, and then the aeroplane disappeared into a cloud. And I think that puzzled him, because the cloud looked solid, the plane looked solid, and yet somehow one had subsumed the other. But obviously he couldn't reach out and touch the cloud and see that the cloud was not solid. So I think that just seeing him experiencing the world was a real inspiration for the book.
People think of blindness as binary, as an on or off switch. Either you can see or you're blind, right? I guess so. But it's a spectrum. Even if you can see, you can only see a tiny portion of all the light that's really there. Did you know that? I've always found that comforting, in a stupid way. It's cool. Alex says nothing. He's looking at his sister in her biker jacket and I want to believe t-shirt, wondering how she can still infuriate him this much after all these years. Her ridiculous sandwich is sitting in front of her, with a toothpick Union Jack flag claiming it for Britain, oozing sweetness onto the plate. Just think about it for a second. You feel the heat of the sun like I do, but you can't see the infrared light glowing off my skin. And you can't see radio waves, even though you know that when you turn the radio on, you'll hear the breakfast news. And it's all made of the same stuff. You just call the bit you can see light. But it's all light, fizzing around our heads. Even at night, when you can't see your hand in front of your face, there's light shining all around. She's grinning like she can see it, all the extra light.
Could you give me a couple of examples of the rules of seeing?
Yeah, absolutely. The thing about the rules of seeing is that you can start very simple, almost scientific definitions. So the first rule of seeing is that if object A occludes object B, object A is closer to you. So all that means really is that if one object appears in front of another, then it's closer, not further away. But then you get onto much more abstract or emotional rules about things like glass, which varies very much depending on the conditions. So it can be see-through, it can be reflective, it can be opaque, it's solid, even though it doesn't necessarily have any appearance. You know, people can walk into glass doors because they don't seem to be there. The idea that something solid can also be see-through is very puzzling. So the rules span lots of things. It was really just an imaginative exercise for me because obviously this is not my experience, and I've really just tried to research the subject as much as possible, find as many first-person accounts as possible, and then imagine myself into that position.
And I know that you're also very keen to avoid the clichés that we have about sight loss and blindness.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the thing that I've always said is that I've tried to research this as thoroughly as possible, but I do not have this experience. And the last thing on earth that I would want is for it to be clichéd or for it to offend anybody or simply for it to be inaccurate. I want it to be as accurate as possible. So having the RNIB be so welcoming and so open to reading the book and providing feedback has been fantastic. One of the things in particular that they pointed out to me was that people with sight loss do not really reach out to touch people's faces to understand faces, that this is something that people do maybe with close family or children, but that really it's a Hollywood trope and it's a cliche. And I just had no idea, and I kicked myself. I was like, how did I let that one through the gate? But I had just, you know, completely believed what I'd seen in so many movies and TV series. It hadn't occurred to me that that could be wrong. And that's why it's invaluable to get the experience of people who really know what they're talking about. And yeah, I'm just very grateful for that.
Pacino in Scent of a Woman has an awful lot to answer for. And yet, actually, you know, confronted with an object in front of us, an inanimate object in front of us, the majority of us, the first thing we would do is give it a good old grope to find out exactly what it is and hope it's not hot or electric.
Yeah.
So before I allow you to get back to the audio recording, are you an audiobook fan yourself?
Oh, I'm. I cannot overstate how much of an audiobook fan I am. I was a very late reader as a child, but the thing that I loved was audiobooks, or I suppose as I would have called them then, story tapes. I'd listen to all sorts of fantastic things, and I still do. Things like Philip Pullman's Northern Lights was, I must have worn the magnetic tape out on that one, I think, from listening to it so many times. So it's very special to be here and to be listening to the audiobook being recorded, because it's something very dear to my heart.
I know that it's going to be something that users of the RNIB library are very, very much going to appreciate, that it's being released simultaneously in audiobook, talking book, and print and electronic.
That's wonderful. I'm absolutely thrilled, and I think HarperCollins are doing a great job to make the book as accessible as possible.
Well, thank you for giving us at Read On the opportunity to be the first people to interview you about The Rules of Seeing, which I'm sure is going to be a huge hit, and I look forward to talking to you
thank
a lot
you
more in the
so
future.
Much, Red. That's fantastic.
How do you learn to see? Because all that extra light, those X-rays and cosmic rays and radio waves, they're all really there, Alex. This big field of pure light is rippling all around you right now. You can't see it. Alex says nothing. He's watching her face, her body, reading silently in a language she doesn't know. Nova goes on. So, say I'm an alien and I've got big old bug eyes. I can see all those extra colours, so your puny human vision seems pathetic to me. I could cure you with my ray gun, because to me, you seem to need curing, and you would see all the light. Night would be like day, shining with colours you've never seen before. She pauses for effect. What would you see? Would you understand it all? Would it scare you, Alex?
Carriad Lloyd narrating The Rules of Seeing, written by my guest, Joe Heap. The Rules of Seeing is out next week in hardback, ebook, and audio, and will simultaneously be available from the RNIB library in a full range of accessible formats. And Joe will be back at the end of the show to share the books of his life.
RNIB. Supporting people with sight loss.
Would you like to chat over the telephone with a group of like-minded people? RNIB's award-winning telephone social groups are small, friendly, and lots of fun. A great way of making new friends and a chance to socialise without leaving the comfort of your home. Telephone RNIB Talk and Support on 0845 330 3723 or email talkandsupport@rnib.org.uk.
I've been thinking of doing a talking book for ages, and a great way to read a book is if you do an audiobook.
Reading for me, as for most of you, maybe all of you, has been a very important part of my life. I can't imagine not being able to pick up a book whenever I want to.
I had this idea of a moment, and I wondered if that moment could become a book.
I think as a writer and the world I work in is creating images all the time, and you want these images to be available to everybody. There should be no reason at all why somebody should not now be able to at least share in what you've seen.
Where did the idea come from? I was just asked if I would want to write it, and because it meant I could stay in a bit, I said yes.
I was at one of my sign-ins and a teenager came up to me. He's in his late teens. He was losing his eyesight. He was almost totally blind. I always remember him because he was in such good spirits about it. And, I just thought, I want my stories to be available to this kid and to anyone else like him.
For more author interviews, to travel behind the scenes, and for some special features, documentaries and short stories, head to www.rnibconnectradio.org.uk and click podcasts.
You're listening to Read On, RNIB Connect Radio's weekly compendium of the best in books and reading. Still to come in this week's show, we'll find out what the Connect Radio book group made of The Rules of Seeing. And Joe Heap will read the letter that he wrote to publishers explaining the inspiration behind his novel. But first, Carriad Lloyd is a stand-up comedian and actress, known for her work on radio and TV. But The Rules of Seeing is her first gig as a narrator, so I was keen to discover how she'd found the experience. Carriad Lloyd, welcome to Read On.
Hello, thank you for having me.
So you're here recording The Rules of Seeing by Joe Heap, his first novel and your first experience as a narrator.
Yes, it is. It's my first audiobook. I've done lots of voiceovers and, various other voiceovers for videos sort of things, but yeah, not proper audiobooks.
You're a comedian originally, aren't you?
Yes, yeah. So I started as a comedian and now I do, I'm sort of I do lots of things. I'm an actor, writer, improviser, performer, whatever someone's willing to pay me to do, really. I really love doing voiceover work and I really love doing different voices. I've done kids shows before where I get to do different voices, because if you're doing an advert voiceover, obviously you don't really get to, you get 10 seconds of and a nice voiceover. So I was very excited about doing a proper audiobook and being able to do different characters and tell a story.
And how are you enjoying The Rules of Seeing?
I love it. I really, really love it. I think it's really nice doing an audiobook because I'm very busy. I have a small child and a lot of work. So I'm struggling to read at the moment, like to find the time. And I don't know if it's a book I would have automatically picked up because I'm always reading for work. So I do a podcast about death and grief. So a lot of the books I'm reading are about grieving and death. So I don't know if I would have automatically picked it up, but I really, really enjoyed reading it and getting to read it again as well on a sort of deeper level. It was really interesting.
It's a remarkably empathetic book, isn't it?
Yes, I think so. Especially for a man writing two female characters. And obviously I'm not blind, but I'm assuming it's empathetic from the blind point of view as well, of someone learning to see for the first time. I think Jo's a really good writer, and there's some really beautiful descriptions in it as well that I definitely sort of noticed the first time, but have been appreciating even more the second time.
And did you do some homework as far as listening to other audiobooks before you sat down to do this?
I didn't do homework. I have just generally listened to audiobooks, and I listen to the radio obsessively. So I'm one of those houses where the radio is just on all the time, to the point that I don't even notice it. My nephew was around and he was like, what's the talking? And I was like, it's the radio. I listen to a lot of, you know, audiobooks on Radio 4 and comedies and that sort of thing. So it's definitely in my world.
It must be quite a thrill walking into the green room and seeing some of the legends of Radio 4, like Garrick Hagan and, you know, half the cast of The Archers, gather in that green room to narrate audiobooks.
Yes, yeah. It's a very familiar roster of faces.
And have you got your next audiobook project lined up already, or are you waiting with your fingers crossed?
I haven't got anything lined up yet. Lots more voiceover work and, you know, radio work. And I just did a voiceover for an Open University clip on igneous rocks. So, you know, sometimes it's a bit more educational than thrilling. So it's quite nice to have a story to tell for a bit.
Do you have a favourite audiobook that you've listened to recently that you'd like to share with the listeners?
Is it a terrible cliche if I say that I really love the Stephen Fry Harry Potter ones? Because that was like my first, I think that was the first ones I sort of really chose to listen to rather than was put on for me. And I used to listen, and, you know, I'm old enough that it wasn't when I was a child. I was listening to them in my early 20s. And I remember just re-listening to the first one over and over with Philosopher's Stone over and over again, because I just thought it felt like the most comforting thing in the world, listening to Stephen do all those voices.
And you'll have the joy of introducing your daughter to them all in the not too distant future.
Yeah, I know. It's nice. It's nice that you get to like start rereading all those old books again. And I've just been forcing her to read Meg and Mogg, which is going down very well. It's a great book.
Carriad Lloyd, thank you so much for coming in and being a guest on Read On.
Thank you.
Rule of Seeing number 36. Bosses, cars, etc. Because glass is both see-through and reflective, the inside of these glass boxes, particularly when in motion, is a constant swimming mixture of images. It is best, where possible, to get close to the window. Otherwise, travel with eyes closed. Anyway, it's pointless. She can understand things when they stand still, but as soon as they start to move, she can't keep track. Leaving the rehab ward, she feels like a foreigner with only a handful of phrases at her disposal. Hello, thank you, where is the bank? Those were enough when she was just holidaying in this foreign place. But now she must do her job, have relationships, have a whole life. All in a language that she barely knows.
Thanks to Carriad Lloyd. And now, in our first visit to the RNIB Connect Radio Book Group, let's hear what they made of her narration.
Can we talk about the book's narrator, Carriad Lloyd? What did everybody think of the actual narration?
I thought she was terrific.
Yes, it was beautifully read, I must say.
Yes, she had a lovely clear voice and she sounds really young.
Yes, she does.
Yeah, but I thought everything, her intonation, her expression, I thought it was lovely.
And the way she changed the voices for different characters.
Yeah.
Very well read indeed.
That is a remarkable skill that has, and not all narrators have it, but I thought she was terrific.
Yes.
I hope she does more, because she was really lovely to listen to. And she definitely had a lovely voice just to listen to, quite apart from the fact that she was reading the book well.
Yes, she had.
So it's safe to say you liked it.
Thanks to Carriad and the book group. Let's hope that The Rules of Seeing is the first of many books narrated by her to enter the RNIB library.
And don't forget that if you've got a favourite narrator or author that you'd like us to feature on the show, you can get in touch with the show via the usual email address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. We'd love to hear from you. You're listening to Read on RNIB Connect Radio. This week we're focusing on a brand new publication that, thanks to HarperCollins, is simultaneously entering the RNIB library in Braille, giant print, and as a talking book. Now, before we return to the Connect Radio book group, here's author Joe Heap with the letter that he wrote to accompany his manuscript when he first sent it out in the hope of finding a publisher.
Writing the Rules of Seeing. There were several inspirations for writing The Rules of Seeing, but one thing stands out above them all. Halfway through work on the book, I became a father for the first time. Sam arrived in the early hours of a frosty February morning, and from the beginning it seemed that he was trying to take in everything around him. Of course, I knew he could barely see a handspan beyond his face, not to mention the fact that everything would still be upside down. Nevertheless, he looked with a sense of urgency, watery blue eyes wide to the world. Through the months that followed, the highs and lows of sleepless nights and developmental milestones, I couldn't help but try to see the world as Sam was seeing it. In some ways, it was frustrating. Here I was, writing about a character learning to see for the first time, while living in the same room as someone who was doing it for real, who couldn't tell me anything. But often his curiosity spoke for itself. Watching Sam track an aeroplane as it crossed the sky and disappeared into a cloud, I realized that he had no idea that some solid-looking objects were not solid at all. Watching his fascination at his own legs through a few inches of soapy bath water, I realized how confusing the concept of transparency must be to him. Why are some things see-through, some opaque, some reflective? I watched him as he saw fire for the first time, and the ocean, and falling snow. There are several cases of people who have lived blind for much of their adult lives, only for an operation to restore some of their vision. They are remarkable stories, but watching Sam, I was constantly reminded that this is a stage we all go through at least once. It's just that very few of us remember what it was like. The Rules of Seeing is, in part, a book about the things we take for granted, or fail to see through overfamiliarity. Sometimes life shocks us out of that trance, and we stand, looking with the same urgency as the day we were born, eyes wide to the world, and really see.
Thanks to Joe for making that exclusive recording for Read On, and giving us such an insight into his reasons for writing the novel. Now, let's return to the RNIB Connect Radio book group and hear what they made of The Rules of Seeing.
But did anybody find it was a bit strange that she couldn't recognise the simplest of objects? I can't give you an example purely because I've forgotten them, I'm afraid. I should have written them down. Sometimes I thought, for such a highly intelligent person as Noah, she had trouble recognising simplest of objects and things.
Perhaps
what does a car look like?
The car, yeah. That's what
that was one of the things that I thought was very clever of Kate to give her the little toy one so that she could feel the shape.
Yeah, that's what I was saying earlier on. If you have got some sight, even if it's a small amount of sight, enough to recognise something, it is very odd if you've never been able to see it before. You look at something and you think, what on earth is that? And then when you pick it up, it's obvious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I know, it must be the kind of link between your brain and your eyes that needs to grow. I found that I've not forgotten what things look like, though. I've been registered blind for 8 years now, and I can still remember what things very clearly because I had... like some, well, not brilliant sight, but had some sight for most of my life. So don't think I will ever forget. But I think if you've never known, it would be difficult to interpret.
The thing is, why did she need a toy car to know what a car looked like? Has she never felt a car?
I think the explanation was that you feel a car's such a big thing. You could feel its bumper, you could feel the windscreen, you could feel door handles and things, but you couldn't put both hands out and feel the whole car.
Yeah.
The toy one, she could feel the whole overall shape of it. Yeah, and then imagine what it would be like multiplied to something
huge. Because I can imagine exactly what it's like, but I don't understand that, I'm afraid. Some of the things that they were saying in the book, I just didn't understand at all, where maybe my experience is different. Mm. I have an image in my brain as to, you know, what things look like. And I couldn't say to you if I could see what they would look like, of course, not having had that experience. But having smaller models of things, I mean, maybe a cathedral, I have felt models of cathedrals where I've gone, you know, touristy things, and they show me what they look like. That's useful, because nobody can feel all 400 feet of architecture. But something every day, like a car or something, I found certain things strange in that book, but perhaps that's some people's experience.
But if you translate the car to your experience of architecture and see it from that point of view, that she feels the miniature and then can visualise it in a much bigger size.
Yeah. Yeah.
I thought that was very clever.
Just a note that these are just short extracts from a full episode of The Book Group discussing The Rules of Seeing, which is coming to RNIB Connect Radio soon. Now, what you were saying, David, I think the book begins with a quote.
Suppose a man born blind and now adult and taught by his touch to distinguish between a cube and a sphere be made to see. Could he, by his sight, before he touched them, now distinguish and tell which was the globe, which the cube?
The answer we've had both from you and from the book is no, they couldn't.
No, not. I mean, you'd be able to see it, but then the message wouldn't quite get through to your brain. You'd have to use the sense that you were used to. I mean, eventually it would come. You know, if somebody put a ball on the table in front of you, you know, eventually, probably it wouldn't take very long either. You know, before you actually say, "Oh, well, that's a ball," but it's like if you lose your sight, then your hearing has to adjust so that if you can no longer see, then without realizing it, really, you actually start using your ears in a way that you never have used before.
Yeah.
And then once you start getting sight back, then again you have to learn to do that. It's a developed skill.
Yes, yeah, so, I mean, I think most people, sighted people, just take their sight totally for granted. I know I did, and when I had good eyesight, took it quite for granted. And, you know, it's only when you start to lose it, you think, oh. And you do have to develop your other senses. I've had to do things like really developing my memory, because I can't write things down or pick up a bit of paper to read a telephone number, so I have to learn it. Remember it, you know, things like that. And I do think you listen far more carefully, and I do agree with what was said earlier about picking up impressions of people from their voice, because they don't bother to hide their voice, whereas they might put on a smile when they're really scowling.
Yeah.
In many ways your perception is sharpened.
Yeah, and as well your sense of touch as well, because you might not be able to see something anymore, but because I have a memory of what things look like, if I touch something, I know what it is.
Yeah.
But I think you have to develop that. You know, at first, right, if it's something, you know, not as obvious as you know, something like a ball or some kind of shape, I think touching it and you think, what is that? You know, well, oh, yes, I know what it is. Now, I found that with jewellery when I want to put jewellery on and, you know, have to touch the piece and think, is it? Oh, yes, I know it's such and such a brooch, you know, that I have.
Well, that was a lively discussion and reflects many of my own views of the book. And we'll hear author Joe Heap's reflections on some books that have meant a lot to him after this.
The RNIB Helpline is your direct line to the support and advice you need. Whatever your inquiry, the RNIB Helpline team are only a call away with practical and emotional support so you can face the future with confidence. Our friendly, specially trained operators are just a phone call away from 8:45 a.m. and to 5:30 p.m. every weekday. We can help with information on everything you need to know about the RNIB, from eye health, advice on how to volunteer, reading services and loads more, or we can simply offer a listening ear. The RNIB Helpline,
here for you on 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999.
It may shock many people to know that in the UK, another 100 people start to lose their sight every day. Now, sight loss can happen to anyone at any time, and the RNIB is there to provide support when it does happen.
Frederick Forsyth on supporting Talking Books.
Talking Books is described as one of the RNIB's most important services. To find out more about Talking Books or to support the RNIB campaign, call 0845 345 0054 or visit www.rnib.org.uk.
And now it's back to Joe Heap, author of The Rules of Seeing, for the books of his life. Joe, was there a book that you read as a child or a young man that made you want to become an author?
Yeah, this is always, it's such an easy question for me because there's such a definite moment, and that was reading Good Omens by Terry Pratchett and Neil Gaiman. And I think my mum gave me the book to read. It had already been read by my parents several times and had been handed around friends, so it was a really battered copy, really well loved. And I just connected with it immediately. For people who don't know it, it's a book about the birth of Satan's son and the impending end of days. And it's about the efforts of an angel and a demon who are friends with each other trying to prevent the end of the world because they don't really want the end of the world. They don't want heaven or hell to be triumphant. They really quite like the grey area of Earth to persist so they can go get a drink and some sushi. And it's just very funny, it's very satirical, it touches on all kinds of things like consumerism and the destruction of the planet and crazy politicians. And I think as someone on the cusp of adolescence, it just resonated with me. I think you're at the point in your life at that age where you start to see a discrepancy with the world that you understood as a child, which is very pastel coloured and innocent, and this world that you're seeing on the news and in front of you. And I think Good Omens for me bridged that gap with a sense of humour, that it made me feel that the world could be understood and it was risible and it was ridiculous and that it was okay to point and laugh at it. And so, yeah, and that's the book that made me want to write, because I think that's an admirable thing to have helped someone feel.
Many phenomena, wars, plagues, sudden audits, have been advanced as evidence for the hidden hand of Satan in the affairs of man. But whenever students of demonology get together, the M25 London Orbital Motorway is generally agreed to be among the top contenders for Exhibit A. Where they go wrong, of course, is assuming that the wretched road is evil simply because of the incredible carnage and frustration it engenders every day. In fact, very few people on the face of the planet know that the very shape of the M25 forms the sigil Odegra, in the language of the black priesthood of ancient Mu, and means, "Hail the great beast, devourer of worlds." The thousands of motorists who daily fume their way around its serpentine lengths had the same effect as water on a prayer wheel, grinding out an endless fog of low-grade evil to pollute the metaphysical atmosphere for scores of miles around. It was one of Crowley's better achievements. It had taken years to achieve, and had involved 3 computer hacks, 2 break-ins, 1 minor bribery, and, on one wet night when all else had failed, 2 hours in a squelchy field, shifting the marker pegs a few but occultly incredibly significant meters. When Crowley had watched the first 30-mile-long tailback, he'd experienced the lovely warm feeling of a bad job well done. It had earned him a commendation. Crowley was currently doing 110 miles per hour somewhere east of Slough. Nothing about him looked particularly demonic, at least by classical standards. No horns, no wings. Admittedly, he was listening to a Best of Queen tape, But no conclusion should be drawn from this, because all tapes left in a car for more than about a fortnight metamorphose into Best of Queen albums. No particularly demonic thoughts were going through his head. In fact, he was currently wondering vaguely who Moe and Chandon were. Crowley had dark hair and good cheekbones, and he was wearing snakeskin shoes, or at least presumably he was wearing shoes, and he could do really weird things with his tongue. And whenever he forgot himself, he had a tendency to hiss. He also didn't blink much. The car he was driving was a 1926 black Bentley, one owner from New, and that owner had been Crowley. He'd looked after it. The reason he was late was that he was enjoying the 20th century immensely. It was much better than the 17th, and a lot better than the 14th. One of the nice things about time, Crowley always said, was that it was steadily taking him further away from the 14th century, the most bloody boring 100 years on God's, excuse his French, earth. The 20th century was anything but boring. In fact, a flashing blue light in his rearview mirror had been telling Crowley for the last 50 seconds that he was being followed by two men who would like to make it even more interesting for him. He glanced at his watch, which was designed for the kind of rich deep-sea diver who likes to know what the time is in 21 world capitals while he's down there. It was custom-made for Crowley. Getting just one chip custom-made is incredibly expensive, but he could afford it. This watch gave the time in 20 world capitals and in a capital city in another place, where it was always one time, and that was too late. The Bentley thundered up the exit ramp, took the corner on two wheels, and plunged down a leafy road. The blue light followed. Crowley sighed, took one hand from the wheel, and half-turning made a complicated gesture over his shoulder. The flashing light dimmed into the distance as the police car rolled to a halt, much to the amazement of its occupants. But it would be nothing to the amazement they'd experience when they opened the bonnet and found out what the engine had turned into.
Jonathan Oliver narrating Good Omens by Terry Pratchett and Neil Gaiman, which is TB 13479. It's also available in Braille and giant print. And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
I found it hard to choose for this, but as a kid I grew up with a lot of sci-fi and fantasy. Both my parents are big fans. One of the books that I've read and reread is Player of Games by Ian M. Banks. Like a lot of his sci-fi novels, it's about the culture, which is a very sophisticated spacefaring culture, civilization, who seem to embody all of the best kind of principles that Ian Banks would like to see in the human race going forward. And they send their best game player, Gergi, to a planet where things are not so nice and things are really rather brutal and probably resemble the world that we're living in now. But this world is entirely predicated on an incredibly complicated game called Azad. And any position that you can have in society, whether it's the president of the world or down to clerical positions and the priesthood, everything is determined by your performance in this game. And so the culture send their best game player to go play this ultimate game as a way of perhaps disrupting this, to them, rather barbaric civilization. And it's just so immersive, it's so brilliantly realized. And I think, again, like Good Omens, it makes you think about the world that you're living in now and makes you feel a bit better about the world that you're living in now.
This is the story of a man who went far away for a long time just to play a game. The man is a game player called Gerge. The story starts with a battle that is not a battle and ends with a game that is not a game. Me? I'll tell you about me later. This is how the story begins. Dust drifted with each footstep. He limped across the desert, following the suited figure in front. The gun was quiet in his hands. They must be nearly there. The noise of distant surf boomed through the helmet sound field. They were approaching a tall dune from which they ought to be able to see the coast. Somehow he had survived. He had not expected to. It was bright and hot and dry outside, but inside the suit he was shielded from the sun and the baking air, cosseted and cool. One edge of the helmet visor was dark, where it had taken a hit, and the right leg flexed awkwardly, also damaged, making him limp, but otherwise he'd been lucky. The last time they'd been attacked had been a kilometre back, and now they were nearly out of range. The flight of missiles cleared the nearest ridge in a glittering arc. He saw them late because of the damaged visor. He thought the missiles had already started firing, but it was only the sunlight reflecting on their sleek bodies. The flight dipped and swung together like a flock of birds. When they did start firing, it was signalled by strobing red pulses of light. He raised his gun to fire back. The other suited figures in the group had already started firing. Some dived to the dusty desert floor, others dropped to one knee. He was the only one standing. The missiles swerved again, turning all at once, and then splitting up to take different directions. Dust puffed round his feet as shots fell close. He tried to aim at one of the small machines, but they moved startlingly quickly, and the gun felt large and awkward in his hands. His suit chimed over the distant noise of firing and the shouts of the other people. Lights winked inside the helmet, detailing the damage. The suit shook and his right leg went suddenly numb. "Wake up, Gerger!" Ye laughed alongside him.
Player of Games by Ian M. Banks is available from the library in Braille, giant print, and as TB15592, and it's narrated by Robbie McNabb. And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the listeners?
Yeah, so I haven't actually finished, but at the moment I'm reading Alan Bennett's latest collection of diaries, Keeping On, Keeping On. It's just so nice to... I actually could have swapped this one for the book that you'd like to curl up with, because this is equally just one of those books that I feel is so immersive and sort of feels like being handed a warm cup of tea, you know. It's so so brilliant, so witty. There's so much in there. I think reading Alan Bennett is a little bit like... It's like someone's trying to knit together all of the disparate parts of your life. He makes connections between ancient history and modern politics. He draws comparisons between spy intrigues of the 1950s and what's going on in Parliament today, and all kinds of different threads between culture and politics and history and architecture and interior design and all of these things. And it's all done completely unpretentiously and very funny. I would definitely recommend that to anybody who hasn't tried them.
8th of November. Listen to the Archive Hour on Radio 4 with Stella Rimington, the ex-head of MI5, taking us through the material the BBC holds on the Cambridge spies, particularly the so-called fifth, or is it sixth, man, John Cairncross. It's all pretty factual, with Rimington banging the treason drum and making the mistake writers on the spies always make, that the whole lives of Burgess, Blunt, McLean and company were taken up with spying. Maybe they should have been, and had they been dutiful Marxists, ought to have been. But spies have lives too, and were, even Blunt, often quite silly, and like everybody else out to have a good time. Arthur Marshall and Victor Rothschild, whose secretary Arthur Marshall briefly was, were the only sensible voices, with Marshall recorded as saying, on, I think, Woman's Hour, that just because someone you like and are fond of does something you disagree with doesn't mean you turn your back on them. Stella Rimington is shocked by this evidence of loyalty and good sense, and asks us to be shocked too. A short extract from An Englishman Abroad ends the programme, only, I think, because it points up how lost and lonely Burgess found himself in Moscow. Astonishing that the ex-head of such a disreputable organisation as MI5 can still expect anyone to care. 10th of November. Did I nod, or has there been any fuss about the speaking clock? I didn't much like the time sponsored by Accuracies, but at least it was sober, and indeed English. Now it's a child who sounds like a fugitive from a John Waters movie who says, "Hi, it's Tinkerbell, at the third bell the time will be," and even the so-called bell sounds silly. I had not thought of time as having a colour. Now it is quite definitely pink, and the texture of time fluffy. Why? And what other country in the world would submit to the time told in an American accent? What is happening to us? Or maybe all this has been said and I've missed it. But God rot the fools who thought it was a good idea. One does try not to be an old git, but they don't make it easy. All my life, Stravinsky complained to Robert Kraft, I have been pursued by my works. But I don't care about my works. I care only about composing. And that is finished. 20th of November. John Sargent retires from the Strictly Come Dancing competition. I have no views on this, but having worked with Sargent on a BBC comedy series in 1966, I can truthfully say that whatever he knows about rhythm and dance, i.e. nothing, he learned from me.
Alan Bennett's Keeping On, Keeping On, his diaries from 2005 to 2015, is available in a full range of accessible formats, including as TB23663, which is narrated by Sean Baker. Jo Heap, thank you so much for sharing your obvious love of books and reading and for being a guest on Read On.
Thank you so much for having me.
Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and to everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week, but if you can't wait that long, why not head to our Audio Boom page? All our past shows are there, complete with book news, reviews, and exclusive author interviews. You'll find a link on the front page of our website, rnibconnectradio.org.uk, or you can find producer Robert on Twitter at @talking_books. Farewell until next week, and remember to read on.